From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A national strike is set for Wednesday in Argentina. Public sector workers plan to converge in front of the presidential palace Wednesday as part of a national strike protesting the policies of the country's new right-wing president, Mauricio Macri. Macri has thus far fired approximately 10,000 state workers since the beginning of 2016, with even more layoffs expected in the coming months. Wednesday's national strike is being organized by the Association of State Workers, known as the ATE, the Argentine Workers Union, and others. ATE President Hugo Godoy said there would be large demonstrations in provincial capitals as well. Macri said that, after the massive layoffs of public sector workers, the private sector should be the source of new employment. Wednesday's actions will take place in the context of a new security protocol implemented by Macri, which now allows police to break up protests. Critics have said the security protocol opens the door to the criminalization and repression of protest. Two items from the war on Syria. First, the Syrian government has accepted the terms of a ceasefire deal announced by the U.S. and Russia. That, reportedly by a foreign ministry source, cited by the official Sana news agency. However, Damascus said it wants the fight against terrorist groups such as the Islamic State to continue. That foreign ministry source added that the Syrian authorities would coordinate with Russia to decide which groups and areas should be included in the cessation of hostilities plan, and that it was important to seal the borders and halt foreign support for armed groups to prevent those organizations from strengthening their capabilities or changing positions to avoid undermining the agreement. Meanwhile, it appears that the previous announcement that Turkey and Saudi Arabia would send ground troops into Syria has been reversed, at least by Ankara. This was Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlüt Cavusoglu, Monday.
If there will be a ground operation, we should do this together with all the coalition member countries. This is not something Turkey or Saudi Arabia would do on their own.
Also on Monday, U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner, at his daily press briefing, said this when asked about Turkey's shelling of targets inside Syria after the implementation of the cessation of hostilities under the agreement.
Does the cessation of hostilities agreement apply to Turkey's actions as well?
You're talking about what? It's shelling over
Syria
the border?
Kurds,
we have called out, we have urged Turkey to stop its shelling over the border.
But does this agreement apply to that as well?
Would I mean, again, we would like Turkey? A cessation of hostility is a cessation of all hostilities on the ground.
Well, Turkish President Erdogan said Turkey has the right to carry out operations in Syria against Kurdish forces because they believe they're terrorists. But since the international community and the U.S. do not consider them terrorists, do you think Turkey has the right to do that?
What we've said, and we've said this last week as well, and our policy has not changed, is that we believe the YPG is not affiliated with the PKK. However, we recognize Turkey's concerns over PKK and terrorism on the ground and its right to defend itself. But we have urged it to stop shelling over the border. We've also told the YPG that it should stop taking actions on the ground in and around Aleppo that, are counterproductive to the situation on the ground, to a de-escalation of the situation on the ground. So, as part of a cessation of hostilities, it's incumbent on all the groups within Syria to either buy in or buy out. And if you buy out, if you refuse to participate, then you're making your decision and you're making it clear that you don't. And that's ultimately the decision of each of these groups on the ground, whether it's the regime, whether it's the opposition, whoever. But it's incumbent on them to live up to the obligations and to buy into the cessation of hostilities. But we've been very clear, we want to see Turkey stop its shelling.
The answer implied in your response is no, Turkey does not have the right to attack YPG in Syria.
It's okay. It's a perfectly fair question. I'm just saying that we have made it clear to Turkey, while we understand their concerns about the YPG, We wanted to stop its shelling.
There was at least one glaring contradiction in the U.S. position that was raised later in the briefing.
The other groups, the moderate groups, in fact, the Free Syria Army, they say that all bombardments should end, of Nusra and ISIS, because they are, they're somehow, they share the same areas and they move from one area to the other. Is that something that you would support? Obviously not. I mean, you're saying that the strikes against ISIS and Nusra would continue, but your allies, the moderates, saying that it all should end. So what is your comment on that?
They fight alongside each other.
Look,
we've been very clear, and we believe we can delineate between Nusra and Daesh and other moderate opposition groups on the ground. We need to keep up, we need to, at the same time, at the same time we put in place a political process and end, we hope, the hostilities on the ground in Syria. We need to continue to put pressure on ISIL. We can't simply call a truce and allow them to be part of any kind of political future in Syria. Is it complex? Certainly. But you understand the principles at stake here. Everybody in the ISSG understands that Daesh represents the enemy. And that's one area of common agreement, frankly.
Now, Mr. Robson,
do I have the privilege of asking who's addressing me?
I'm Richard Arend.
That was Paul Robeson at the beginning of a hearing before the House Un-American Activities Committee, where he was grilled over a number of issues after having been refused a passport because he would not sign a declaration that he was not a communist. Last month marked the 40th anniversary of Robeson's passing. Next, we will take you back to that HUAC hearing in June of 1956, and then a discussion between Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Radio and Professor Gerald Horn of the University of Houston.
What is your position?
I'm director of the staff. Did you file a passport application in July 2, 1954?
I filed about 25 in the last few months.
In July of 1954, were you requested to submit a non-communist affidavit?
Under no conditions would I think of signing such an affidavit. It is a contradiction of the rights of American citizens.
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Oh, please. Please, please.
Please answer, will you, Mr. Robeson?
What is the Communist Party? What do you mean by that?
Are you now a member of the Communist Party?
Would you like to come to the ballot box when I vote and take out the ballot and see?
Mr. Chairman, I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question.
You are directed to answer the question.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment and forget it.
I respectfully suggest the witness be directed to answer the question whether, if he gave us a truthful answer, he would be supplying information which might be used against him in a criminal proceeding.
You are directed to answer, Mr. Robeson.
In the first place, wherever I have been in the world, the first to die in the struggle against fascism were the communists. I laid many wreaths upon the graves of communists. That is not criminal. Chief Justice Warren has been very clear that the Fifth Amendment does not have anything to do with the inference of criminality, and I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Have you ever been known under the name of John Thomas?
Oh, please, does somebody here want me to put up a perjury someplace? John Thomas, my name is Paul Robeson, and anything I have to say, I have said in public all over the world, and that is why I'm here today.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that you direct the witness to answer the question he's making a speech.
I ask you to affirm or deny the fact that your Communist Party name was John Thomas.
I invoke the Fifth Amendment. This is really ridiculous.
The witness talks very loud when he makes a speech, but when he invokes the Fifth Amendment, I can't hear him.
I have medals for diction. Huh? I can talk plenty loud.
Will you talk a little louder?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment loudly.
Sir, who are Mr. and Mrs. Vladimir
Makiev? I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Manning Johnson?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know Gregory Kifetz?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Do you know a Max Juergen?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Max Juergen.
Why don't you have these people here to be cross-examined? Could I ask whether this is legal?
This is not only legal, but usual. By unanimous vote, this committee has been instructed to perform this very distasteful task.
To whom am I talking?
You're speaking to the chairman of the committee.
Mr. Walter?
Yes.
The Pennsylvania Walter?
That is right.
Representative of the steel workers?
That is right.
And the coal mining workers?
That is right.
Not United States Steel, by any chance. Our great patriot.
That is right.
You are the author of the bills that are going to keep all kinds of decent people out of the country.
No, only your kind.
Colored people like myself. And you would let in the Teutonic Anglo-Saxon stock.
We are trying to make it easier to get rid of your kind, too.
You don't want any colored people to come in. Could I be allowed to read from my statement?
Will you just tell this committee, please, while under oath, Mr. Robeson, the communists who participated in the preparation of that statement?
Oh, please. The reason I'm here today, from the mouth of the State Department itself, is I should not be allowed to travel because I have struggled for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa. The other reason I'm here today, again, from the State Department and from the record of the Court of Appeals, is that when I am abroad, I speak out against injustices against the Negro people in this land. That is why I'm here. I'm not being tried for whether I'm a communist. I'm being tried for fighting for the rights of my people, who are still second-class citizens in this country, in this United States of America. My mother was born in your state, and my mother was a Quaker. And my ancestors, in the time of Washington, baked bread for George Washington's troops when they crossed the Delaware. My father was a slave. I stand here struggling for the rights of my people to be full citizens in this country. And we are not. We are not in Mississippi. We are not in Montgomery, Alabama. We are not in Washington. We are nowhere. And that is why I am here today. You want to shut up every Negro who has the courage to stand up and fight for the rights of his people, for the rights of workers, and I have been on many a picket line for the steel workers, too. And that is why I'm here today.
Would you tell us whether or not you know Thomas W. Young?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment.
Thomas W. Young is a Negro president of the Guide Publishing Company. I'd like to read you his testimony, quote, Paul Robeson has no moral right to place in jeopardy the welfare of the American Negro to advance a foreign cause. In the eyes of the Negro people, this false prophet is unfaithful to their country, and they repudiate him, close quote. Do you know the man that said that?
I invoke the Fifth Amendment now. Can I read my statement? It is a sad and bitter comment.
While you were in Paris in 1949, Mr. Robeson, did you tell an audience the American Negro would never go to war against the Soviet government?
May I say that is slightly out of context. May I explain to you what I did say? I remember the speech very well. 2,000 students who came from populations that would range to 600 or 700 million people asked me to say in their name that they did not want war. No part of my speech in Paris says 15 million American Negroes would do anything. I said it was my feeling that the American people would struggle for peace, and that has been since underscored by the President of these United States. Now, in passing, I said...
Do you know any people who want war?
Listen to me. I said it was unthinkable to me that any people could take up arms in the name of a man like Senator Eastland of Mississippi against anybody. Gentlemen, I still say that. This United States government should go to Mississippi and protect my people. That is what it should do.
I lay before you, sir, an article. Quote, I am looking for full freedom, unquote, by Paul Robeson in The Worker. July 3rd, 1949, quote, I said it was unthinkable that the Negro people of America or elsewhere could be drawn into war with the Soviet Union. I repeat it with 100-fold emphasis, they will not, close quote.
And, gentlemen, they have not. It is clear that no Americans are going to go to war with the Soviet Union.
While you were in Stockholm, did you make a little speech?
I made all kinds of speeches.
Let me read you a quotation.
Let me listen.
Do so, please.
I am a lawyer.
It would be a revelation if you would listen to counsel.
In good company, I usually listen. But you know, people wander around in such fancy places.
You said, Mr. Robeson, and I quote, I belong to the American resistance movement, which fights against American imperialism. just as the resistance movement fought against Hitler.
Just like Douglas and Harriet Tubman were underground railroaders and fighting for our freedom, you bet your life.
I have to insist that you listen to these questions.
I am listening.
I quote further, why should the Negroes ever fight against the only nation in the world where racial discrimination is prohibited and where the people can live freely? Never. They will never fight against either the Soviet Union or the people's democracies, close quote. Did you make that statement?
I do not remember, but what is perfectly clear today is that 900 million people, other colored people, have told you they will not. 400 million in India and millions everywhere have told you
that.
The
witness has answered the question. He doesn't need to make a speech.
Did you write an article that was published in the USSR Information Bulletin?
Yes.
Quote, I want to emphasize that only here in the Soviet Union did I feel that I was a real man with a capital M, close quote.
I would say, what is your name?
Aaron.
I am quite willing to answer the question. When I was a singer years ago, and this you will have to listen to.
I am listening.
I am a bass singer, and so for me, it was Chelyabin, the great Russian bass, not Caruso the tenor. I learned the Russian language to sing their songs. I wish you would listen now.
Mr. Chairman, I ask you to direct the witness to answer the question.
Just be fair with me.
I ask for order.
The great poet of Russia is of African blood.
Well, let's not go so far afield.
It is important to explain this.
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
When I first went to Russia in 1934...
Did you make that statement?
In Russia, I felt for the first time like a full human being. No color prejudice like in Mississippi. No color prejudice like in Washington. It was the first time I felt like a human being. Well, I do not feel the pressure of color as I feel it in this committee today.
Why do you not stay in Russia?
Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country. And I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?
You are here because you are promoting the communist cause.
I am here because I am opposing the neo-fascist cause, which I see arising in these committees. Jefferson could be sitting here, and Frederick Douglass could be sitting here. Eugene Debs could be sitting here.
Now, what prejudice are you talking about? You were graduated from Rutgers, and you were graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. I remember seeing you play football at Lehigh. There was no prejudice against you.
Just a moment. This is something I challenge very deeply, that the success of a few Negroes can make up for $700 a year for thousands of Negro families in the South. My father was a slave, and I have cousins who are sharecroppers. I do not see success in terms of myself. I have sacrificed hundreds of thousands of dollars for what I believe in.
While you were in Moscow, Mr. Robeson, did you make a speech lauding Stalin?
I can't remember.
Have you recently changed
your
mind about Stalin?
What has happened to Stalin, gentlemen, is a question for the Soviet Union, and I won't argue with a representative of the people who, in building America, wasted the lives of my people. You are responsible, you and your forebears, for 60 to 100 million black people dying in the slave ships and on the plantations. Mm-hmm. Don't you ask me about anybody.
I'm sure you wouldn't want to discuss with us the slave labor camps in the
Soviet
Union.
Nothing could be built more on slavery than this society, I assure you.
I would invite your attention to the Daily Worker of June 29, 1949, with reference to a get-together with you and Ben Davis, formerly Communist Councilman in New York. Do you know Ben
Davis?
One
of my dearest friends. He is as patriotic an American as can be. And you, gentlemen, are the non-patriots.
Just a minute.
You are the un-American.
The hearing is now adjourned.
I think it should be.
I've endured all of this that I can.
Can I read my statement?
No! The meeting is adjourned!
It should be.
Paul Robeson left a massive legacy of top works in fields as diverse as theater, music, film, and sport. He excelled academically and was a graduate of Columbia Law School. But the thread that tied all of his achievements together was a vast knowledge of history and an epical political understanding of the world around him. Yet, he has been written out of the history of the United States, of the civil rights movement here in the U.S., and of the global human rights movement. That omission is part of the subject matter of a new book by Dr. Gerald Horn of the University of Houston. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with Dr. Horn about that glaring omission.
Paul Robeson was an NFL class athlete, spoke 12 languages, a movie star who was one of the biggest draws in the American musical theater, and was probably the best known American in the world at the height of his popularity in the early 1940s. Yet, no more than 20 years later, the crusading artist and social activist's name had been all but erased from public discourse in the United States. How could that happen? We asked Dr. Horn.
I'm giving a talk at NYU in a few weeks on Paul Robeson and the movement for socialism that he represented. And I've been toying with a title that goes something like this, that Robeson misjudged the superpower, but it was not the Soviet Union. That is to say that Robeson has been excoriated on this side of the Atlantic, in particular because of the fact that, like the United States, between June 22nd, 1941, and September 1st, 1945, he felt that it was necessary to ally with the socialist camp in order to beat back fascist antagonists. Now, it's accepted wisdom in the United States that it was okay for FDR to ally with the Soviet Union to fight its antagonists, speaking of Nazi Germany in the first place, but it was not okay for Paul Robeson to ally with the Soviet Union to fight the lynchers and the neo-fascists in Dixie. Indeed, the turning point for Paul Robeson came perhaps in 1946 when he had a meeting in the White House with then U.S. President Harry S. Truman, a former Ku Klux Klan member, and he got in Harry Truman's face and wagged his finger and castigated and denounced the U.S. president as his face was turning purple, that is to say, Truman's face, because of Truman's lethargy in prosecuting lynchers, some of whom had been lynching black soldiers just back from the war in their uniforms, at the same time that the Truman administration was vigorously prosecuting Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg. Truman did not appreciate this comparison, and you can mark that confrontation as the point where Paul Robeson's career began to go downhill. It was not long after that the Truman administration revoked his passport, making it virtually impossible for Paul Robeson to travel abroad to make a living, sounding the same tune you sound many concert halls and promoters refusing to allow him to grace their stages, and soon Paul Robeson's income plummeted from the six figures to the low four figures. He became a virtual non-person, but in some ways, Paul Robeson was a sacrificial lamb, because at the same time this was taking place in the 1950s, you may recall that the U.S. ruling elite moved to make halting steps away from the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow, that is to say, Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court decision May 17, 1954, which suggested that Jim Crow was no longer constitutional. Paul Robeson played a major role in helping to bring that result about because, as myself and other historians have argued, it was international pressure that forced the U.S. ruling elite to bend. The U.S. Supreme Court, which for the most part, in its undistinguished history, has had an unbroken record of reactionary politics, somehow found the courage to move against Jim Crow, and I think it's because of this international pressure. You see that there was a backlash against this move against Jim Crow, as represented in the riots in Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1957, when President Eisenhower had to send federal troops into the halls of Central High School in order to enforce a judicial edict on desegregation, or in the 1970s, when you had riots in South Boston over busing of black children into predominantly white high schools. In other words, there was a grassroots rebellion amongst many Euro-Americans against desegregation, and it was international pressure led by Paul Robeson that helped to bring this result about. And it's striking to note that it was in 1951 that Paul Robeson, in conjunction with the now defunct Civil Rights Congress led by his good friend and comrade William Patterson, that filed a petition at the United Nations charging the U.S. with genocide against Black Americans. It's been only recently that the idea of going to the U.N. has had a resuscitation, so to speak, with the U.N. coming to Chicago in particular in January 2016, and with the U.N. working group basically endorsing the concept of reparations and castigating and raising questions about the U.S. approach to racism. When the United Nations came to Chicago and a number of U.S. cities just a few weeks ago, in many ways, they were echoing what Paul Robeson had done decades ago. And hopefully this recent visit of the United Nations will lead to a similar positive result. That is to say, positive result for Black people, certainly not a positive result for Paul Robeson personally.
Paul Robeson was such an accomplished intellect, a linguist in sports, in the arts, that he was the kind of Black person that the NAACP could be expected to be most proud. And yet the NAACP participated in making him a non-person in America.
That is correct. And this was a turnabout for the NAACP, because before the advent of the Red Scare and the Cold War, the NAACP was in Paul Robeson's corner. They gave him their highest award, the Spingarn Medal. Walter White, their then leader, was fawning all over him at every opportunity. But once the U.S. ruling elite decided that anyone who advocated socialism on a serious level had to be isolated and marginalized, the NAACP flip-flopped and became one of the sternest critics of Paul Robeson. It's quite ironic. And with regard to your point about Paul Robeson's intellect, and doing this biography and doing the research for it, I still am astounded and astonished by the fact that Paul Robeson was a serious student of philology, or the construction of languages. It's said by one commentator that, for example, he began the study of Norwegian in the morning and by the evening was writing that language. He had a knowledge of Chinese. You might recall that the FBI purloined a notebook of Paul Robeson's writings in Chinese. They thought it was some sort of secret message from the Chinese Communist Party. It was actually only his working out serious questions of grammar. Paul Robeson spoke Russian. He spoke a number of African languages. He studied indigenous languages of Mexico. He read Marx in German and Lenin in Russian. This was probably the most serious intellect that not only Black America, but the United States has produced to this point.
Certainly, Paul Robeson reached the highest pinnacles of all of his professions, but he dedicated his life to the service of humanity without regard to his own reputation and material possessions. Is he the kind of example that today's artists and athletes ought to be studying, looking up to?
Well, clearly. I mean, the subtitle of this book was chosen with intent and consciousness, that is to say, the artist is revolutionary. Because today, as during the era of Paul Robeson, artists, popular artists, have a lot of influence on mass consciousness. But all too often, they do not use this influence and impact for a positive purpose. And to that extent, they're going against the grain that Paul Robeson helped to create. Because Paul Robeson, as you suggested, readily relinquished a fortune, if not fame, in order to dedicate his life to the battering down of the walls of Jim Crow and the battering down of the walls of colonialism in Africa. You may know that it was Paul Robeson who was the leading force behind the Council on African Affairs, which came into existence in the 1930s, and was the premier organization for years in terms of crusading against colonialism. It was Paul Robeson who befriended Jomo Kenyatta, the founding father of modern Kenya in London, who befriended Kwame Nkrumah, the founding father of Ghana, who befriended the founding fathers of Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation with its most sizable economy. And that's one of the reasons why he was heralded in Africa in particular, because they knew who their true friends were. at a time when the United States, U.S. imperialism to be more specific, was the major force backing London, Paris, Lisbon in particular, in their diabolical schemes to perpetuate colonialism in Africa forevermore.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.